gum.
No.
It's the E E E E E E E.
File.
One for the bloop.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Season 5, Episode 11 of Lug Radio. Today, it's a bumper show. Oh.
No, I was just making a noise. Carry on.
Don't.
I can't. Why can't I extol air in a
loud way on microphone?
You should never be allowed to extol air.
In a weird old mannish voice.
So anyway, you were talking about the bumper show.
Yes, it's a bumper show, which means there's one bum per show. No, it's a bumper show this week, which means that we've got loads of stuff to whip through. So we're not going to talk about much of it at the moment because we're going to forget what all of it is. But we are going to cover in this show
my name, your name, Adam's name, and Chris's name,
which are
bum 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 bum.
This can be saved. Tell them your name.
All right, okay. We're going to carry on.
Carry on.
That was the usual the cut it sound. My name is Jono Bacon.
Somehow, or I fear I was optimistic.
No, I think it's worth it. I'm Stuart Langridge.
I'm Adam Sweet.
I'm Chris Proctor.
And I'm
and we did some segments.
Oh, so yeah,
no, we're going to do it. We're going to do it. Right, welcome to Lug Radio. Press stop.
What?
In the last show, a bloke called Axel Lilienkrantz.
I was say, at that point, I assume that Guildenstern was busy that week.
Anyway, Mr. Lilienkrantz wrote in and said, I think you should do a feature on fish. It's a wicked cool command line show. And then right at the end went, oh yeah, and I wrote it, by the way. So,
in a new segment called Bored Excitement.
Now, you see, that's not true, is it?
No, I'm right. Joking. I'm
you're bored by the segment.
I've tried fish.
Really?
Okay.
No, don't tell us all about it.
Actually, yes. So why don't you tell us about it?
So, absolutely, I think that's reasonable. I mean, we said we'd go away and we'd try fish. So, Jono, tell us about your experiences with fish.
It's actually, well, what I did is I switched it on using Chusha and I changed my shell to fish. And I tried it for a week. And some things that relied on Bash didn't quite work right.
Really?
You're lying, aren't you?
That sounds rather like you repeating the stuff I said in a phone call earlier. Which command line parameter did you use to Chusha to actually change your shell?
Sure.
Fail. You fail, right? Jono didn't do any of that. How much did you actually use it for?
About 0% of my week.
The rest of you?
I had a go for about 15 minutes, but I was at work, so I can't afford to waste time on your shell. I don't know.
Yeah, it was about 15 minutes, and yes.
So I'm the only person who actually tried it out.
I did have a stab at reading the manual, but there's fucking loads of it, and also I just shortcut routed to an article on Linux Weekly, whatever it's called.
What exactly? News. What exactly happens when you shortcut route something?
You take a route and you try to shortcut it.
Anyway, moving on.
Shall we move on?
Yes. I mean, the reason I want to try it is just because I'm interested what the point is of having another shell.
Yeah.
I mean, why does anyone give a shit?
Yeah.
You keep it, every now and again you hear people say, oh, you should use Zedsha or whatever, and you think, well, why? I don't care.
It's
why
kind of analogous to when people say, you know, they change the handles on their doors in their kitchens. To me, it's like just a handle. But you know, to other people, they care about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
To be honest, if you do a lot of shell scripting and stuff like that, you actually write shell scripts, then Bash has issues.
Well, this was...
And so rewriting it to be something good would be...
Unlike Fisheithon or something.
Unlike you bunch of slackers, I actually tried this. I thought a week ago, I'll change my shell to fish and then just work with it for a week. I can't understand how Adam doesn't do that and Chris doesn't do that because...
It's only because you're
they might lose their job.
You had nothing else to do.
That's completely untrue.
Sorry, what has happened in Jeremy Kyle this week, Mr. Bacon?
Ah. Fail, Bacon. Anyway. And
Lug Radio is brought to you by the word fail.
Speaking of someone who does a certain amount of shell scripting,
we're going to talk to Chris then.
Like Chris says, Bash has annoying bits about it.
Yes.
Like when you do 4F in whatever, and whatever's the list of files and the file names have spaces in, it screws it up.
Yes. Yep.
And Fish doesn't do that.
Yep.
It's I've found it, to be honest with you, 95% of what I use a shell for is to type in the name of a program, and every shell works exactly the same.
So what is it about fish that the typical Linux user should care about?
To be honest with you, if you're not a command line, if you're not a pretty heavy command line user, nothing.
You probably won't notice the difference.
Yes, right, if you are a heavy command line user, then there are reasons to think about switching. If you find bash to be annoying when you do things like loop over something and spaces screw up, or you get annoyed with the quoting.
So you've got to know bash is annoying to really care about fish.
If you think bash is annoying, then that doesn't seem to be the case with Zedsha. Zedsha seems to be more about working kind of like, I haven't actually used it in any detail, but working kind of like bash, but going beyond bash. Fish is kind of different. It's, I found things that were annoying about bash, and I'm doing it a different way, even though that means I'm not POSIX compliant.
The problem I had really with it is, and I think the same problem Adam had with it, is, yeah, you know enough about bash. If you know enough about bash to know it's annoying, you use it a lot, and therefore can't really do away with it.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, the fact that I can't, if I use fish on my machine at work, if I then move to another machine, like, I have to have fish on there, or I have to revert back to using bash anyway, in which case I might as well stay the
consistent. I think it's useful for occasional people to, for the same reason that when Ubuntu switched bin sh to be dash rather than bash, and it broke every shell script that's ever existed.
Yes.
Because everyone said, oh yeah, bin sh, and just assumed it was bash when it doesn't need to be. Again, using fish, I mean, I've had a couple of things show up this week where it didn't work because it basically assumed I was using bash even though I'm not. Mm. And it's useful to have some people do that just to make sure that we're not getting locked into bashness if a new shell comes on that everyone likes. But it's just, it's not that. Fish has got a couple of nice touches, but I wouldn't necessarily say everyone should switch.
It seems to me, really, that, I mean, I was just thinking, I was laughing when I was listening to you talking, thinking, fucking hell, next week on Shells of the Interesting and Famous. But, it seems to me that, I mean, I don't want to piss on the guy's project, but you're only going to get something out of changing shell to fish if you do enough shell shit to make and have the time to invest in learning all the cool stuff that fish does, because it does a lot of cool stuff that most of the other shells don't do. And it seems
it does a lot of cool stuff a lot more easily than other shells, but, I think, as I said,
most of my stuff at work is done at the command line, but I just didn't have the time to invest in learning the cool stuff that fish did.
Yeah.
And again, as Chris said, unless you're going to invest your life in using fish on everything you use, you're kind of wasting your time learning a new shell, in a sense.
It does seem to me that, you know, 1% of people in the world use Linux, and 1% of those people use a shell, and 1% of those people use a shell enough that it matters. So this guy is doing his level best to optimize the experience for, like, 9 guys.
You've got
to
be careful.
Those 9 guys appreciate it a lot.
You should be careful when referring to 1% of 1% of 1%, given the almighty booting we got on the forum.
I've got to be honest. I think you're stretching a bit by saying 1% of Linux users use KDE. I think it was
somewhat of a pithy remark.
Right.
Well, it
was a lies remark designed to annoy KDE people. But
I'd really like to have the time to invest in learning fish, and I think that could make my working a lot faster.
Good for you.
It really needs a big distro to pick it up and use it instead of bash. Yeah. In which I'd be very happy to learn it.
Based on my week of experience with it, just to wind this up, it doesn't seem to me to be a hugely better shell for writing shell scripts in. It's better at being an interactive shell than bash, I think.
Right.
Just stupid little things like the command history. If you type some of the command and then hit up, it takes you back to the last thing. You'd have to remember to hit Control R first. Yeah. And if you get halfway through a command and then type Control R in bash, it doesn't work properly and stuff. So fish does that kind of thing better.
So thanks very much, Axel, for sending your project. And it's good to hear about these projects. Other people do send your projects in to show@lugradio.org, and we might give them a road test. And when I say we, I mean Ack. Years ago, when Adam was on tour with his band, he was busted for giving out E's. But
I'm fucking busted.
But we're different. We're special. We're going to be giving out some E's Three particular E's in the Triple E PC competition.
We are. Well, we already have announced this competition, you may remember. We want you to send in a piece of promotional material for Lug Radio.
Yes.
And we've had loads of entries, actually.
There's been some excellent entries.
Which yes, is,
and there's been some shit entries.
Which is...
yes, which is probably insulting entries as well.
Bearing in mind that we've seen the entries, Chris got a booty in one of them, but he's not the only one, let us be frank about it. Mr. Bacon has received an almighty kicking him as well.
Yeah,
it's fantastic.
Maybe we were wrong when we were saying, you know, maybe we didn't make it clear enough about this is about the show, not about specific people.
No. send in audio
that
in
one of Chris's
send in audio insulting Jono as much as you want. But the important thing is you need to get your entries in by the 18th of February.
18th.
Because yep. That's when you have to get them
in. That's the closing date.
Yeah, that's the closing date. And then we're going to announce the winner in the show after that date.
Yep. So, get your entries in. If you go to lugradio.org/pimpmylugradio, you can find out the details of how to enter. And it is literally send us in something, a promotional piece of whatever
We've had pictures, we've had video, we've had audio. We've had someone sent an application.
Yeah.
So it's just cool. It's
banner ads.
Banner ads.
Yeah, we've had banner ads. Yeah,
images. Stuff.
So insulting arse photos.
That was the comedic.
There's like one person chuckling.
So, and now we're going to get loads of them, so thanks a lot for that. But yes, entries in by the 18th of February, if you please, to win an Asus EEPC.
I have a little bit of a story to tell you guys.
It's exciting.
It is very exciting, nearly as exciting as the Storage Expo.
Pretty exciting, then.
For a while now, as you will know, I've had a laptop which has had a broken keyboard.
Yes.
And I've been carrying this keyboard around with me, which has had many nicknames applied to it.
I thought the nicknames were applied to you. Nobody minded the keyboard.
So anyway... I was thinking about buying a new keyboard, so I asked on my website for suggestions.
New laptop, not new keyboard.
New laptop, yes. And I had various suggestions, all of which lived in my spam moderation queue, which I only discovered 2 days ago. So thanks for your comments that never got read. Anyway, a certain Adam Sweet suggested, why don't you open up the keyboard, open up the laptop. The ribbon cable may have come loose, so I did that. Laptop stopped working.
Well,
thanks a lot.
As I said on your blog, I was assuming that you could open the laptop and replace, make sure the ribbon cable is fitted correctly without breaking the rest of the laptop.
I was assuming Jono was competent.
You've got to mention, oh yeah, don't pour a pint of Coke into here while you're doing it.
I did that into a guitar amp once. Makes a hell of a stink.
Doesn't surprise me.
Anyway. So, laptop broken and I need to buy a new laptop. So I bought one of the new Dell M1330s, which people may have seen as they have been have got Ubuntu pre-installed now.
Ironically enough.
That was announced a week after I bought mine.
So you bought the Windows one?
So I bought one which comes pre-installed with Vista, which never got booted, and thought it might be interesting to talk about it. It's a good laptop. It's a really good laptop. I've always been a bit suspicious of Dell laptops because I've always felt they've been a bit plastic and tacky. And this one feels, with the exception of the keyboard, feels a little plasticky. It feels like a nice, rugged laptop.
It does look quite nice, I must admit.
And it looks like they're kind of heading in the direction of an Apple, but not quite there yet.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I mean, it's a XPS laptop, which is the gaming level, performance level laptops, isn't it?
So the one I bought is a 1.66 gigahertz Celeron with 2 gig of RAM, 160 gig disk, Intel graphics. Now, I got a shoeing.
Why don't you tell us about the graphics?
I got a shoeing from ACK last time for saying that I'd buy a laptop anyway because I wanted the non-free driver in the last episode.
Yeah.
Because there was a guy who was going to offer to sell me one of these laptops, and then when I actually saw it on the Dell site, he was actually cheaper, so I bought the one with the Intel graphics.
And good on you. Well done.
For the freedom, even though I knew full well that Compiz wasn't going to work.
Well,
Compiz is the only thing that I can tell on the laptop that doesn't work.
And that's only because... it's been explicitly blacklisted, the card has or something, isn't it?
Yeah, the card's been blacklisted because there are some problems with it. You can switch Compiz on, but video doesn't work quite right. So
what actually does work on it that is kind of you wouldn't expect to have worked?
Well, so I installed Gutsy on there, and went through the normal installation. Everything worked. The webcam works. Obviously, the screen works. The VGA out works. The HDMI port kind of works. We tested that tonight.
Yeah.
Pretty much works. I haven't tested the SD card reader. There's a little remote control thing that comes with it that works. All of the they've got really nice MIDI keys on there. They all work.
They all glow blue in a really exciting fashion.
I like that.
Are you ready for this? So there's going to be a few people out there who've just bought one of these with Ubuntu on it. So this question goes out for them. Jono, does the fingerprint reader work? And they're all going, what a fucking fingerprint reader?
Yeah, as far as I'm aware, the machine that's been that's got Ubuntu pre-installed in it doesn't have the Intel graphics, which is a shame.
What does
and
it have?
It's got the NVIDIA card.
NVIDIA? Can you believe it?
Which is why I was asking you to tell us about the graphics.
Right, so that's one thing. Now, as far as I'm aware, this is the case. They may have changed, I don't know. But it comes pre-installed. It's got the NVIDIA graphics card in there, and it doesn't have the fingerprint reader. The fingerprint reader is supported. It uses ThinkFinger, which I've got to work, but I haven't hooked it up to GDM properly yet. It's the only thing you have to poke with to get it working on this machine.
I find that deeply, deeply bizarre. That the Windows one, you can say, oh, I want it with the Intel graphics, but if you buy the Ubuntu one, they put an NVIDIA graphics card in it. The wireless is
It does seem a bit upside down, doesn't
wireless
it?
Wireless is non-free.
Is that so Compiz will work on it, though?
I think that'll be why.
The logic is...
Yeah.
We install Ubuntu with...
Is it likely to be supported properly?
Well, part of the reason why I bought the Intel is that even though it's not 100% working, I figured, well, Intel are heading in the right direction in terms of free drivers. Yeah. And it's likely to be working.
And I'm guessing that's why they've used the NVIDIA one in the laptops, Ubuntu ones now, because it works.
The NVIDIA card works 100% with Compiz and everything.
It's a shame, that it really is.
It is a shame.
Yeah.
But, you know, Intel are doing a good job, and I think they're getting in the right direction.
Yeah,
so
spot that kind of thing.
The fingerprint reader is a surprise, considering it's supported.
It seems weird to me.
The thing is, as well, is, to clarify, this laptop that I bought was about £600, VAT and shipping included. So it's not a hugely expensive laptop. So clearly fingerprint readers aren't that expensive, you know? It came as standard. I didn't add that. That wasn't an additional extra. That was standard with the M1330.
So they've explicitly had to take it out. I wonder
as
why.
As far as I'm aware. I mean, I read this the other day.
Your point about it was that, yes, you can get the fingerprint reader itself to work, but hooking up GDM's a pain in the arse. So you may find... If they shipped Ubuntu with the fingerprint reader, people would expect to be able to use it to log in.
I think
they don't want to ship things that aren't going to work properly for people all the time.
That aren't going to be obviously working.
Just a case of the way they set up Ubuntu
I was going to say, surely if it's you can frig it to work, why don't they just frig it to work?
It depends, because naturally you'd want a nice GUI front end to scan in your finger, and then
there is no such GUI front end,
and that doesn't really exist. Okay. So I think that's part of the problem.
Submit your fingerprint in ASCII art, have you?
You got to go through it and type it in. You're like, okay, so that's a wall, and then a line, and then another wall, and then a loop, and then a line, and then a loop.
The thing that impressed me about it, though, was that, you know, for years and years and years, Linux on laptops was always like, ooh, a bit risky.
Yeah.
This is arguably the most, one of the most hyped Dell machines that's come out for a long time. A lot of people are using it. It's got consistently good reviews.
It looks great.
It's a really nice looking laptop because they've tried to make something that looks decent apart from anything. And it's not, I mean, it still looks like a Dell machine, but it's not an Apple machine, but it's looking nice. But the thing I liked is that I installed Gutsy on there, and with the exception of the fingerprint reader and Compiz, everything works.
Does all the suspend and resume and all that kind of stuff?
It's got a modem built in.
I think so. I haven't tested that. And I haven't tested the LAN port.
So I've got a Dell XPS laptop myself. Admittedly, probably 2.5 times the size and 2.5 times the price.
And 2.5 times more powerful.
Well, yeah. Yeah, but
it's a monster, that thing.
I look 2.5 times more like I've got a small cock.
Which
isn't true, incidentally.
Also, 2.5 times more LEDs all over it.
I'm thinking now, really, if I'd have waited 6 months, I probably would have, and seen what you've got for your money, I would have liked to have bought what you bought, but I bought mine because I wanted a mobile desktop replacement.
Yeah, I mean, this part of the reason, I was really after like a 12-inch screen.
And I hate Freedom because I bought a fucking fancy NVIDIA graphics card. Hands in the air, I'm sorry.
I mean, I wanted a smaller, because I was using a small Vio, and I like that, but this... I was always wanting, with the Vio, I was wanting something a little bit bigger because it was a bit too small. This machine is nice. It's in between the small
13.3.
Right. Yeah. And it's a nice It's a nice looking machine. It's a nice build quality.
I've got
everything works.
Really keyboard's boring question.
No,
this is my really boring question actually, because you know that the Sony VAIOs we did to do the distro test on.
Yeah.
I really can't get used to the keyboard on that. Really can't.
No, I can't. I used it for a while. Couldn't get used.
Right,
to
and
it.
You're used to using a VAIO as well, aren't you?
Yeah. The VAIO on my small VAIO was fine.
Right.
Well, on that big VAIO, it's no.
Right, I can't get used to it. No, but my Dell laptop keyboard, I really, really like.
We'll have to check it. Is yours like the thick fat keys?
They are quite thick,
plasticky keys.
Yeah,
it must be the same kind of.
So you're slagging off Storage Expo. Now we're having a conversation about keyboards.
Sorry, I mean, yeah. Well, the thing is,
I didn't raise this issue.
It's my fault. I knew it was going to be boring in advance. But my, I really
let's
like
talk about sex.
No, we're not allowed to do that anymore, are we?
We're not allowed to. Yeah.
I think it's jolly good for two reasons. First of all, I think it's jolly good that you can now get Linux and stick it on a high-profile laptop from a high-profile laptop manufacturer, and all the hardware.
But to be fair, Lenovo, you could always get, if you looked around, you could get a Linux installed on them. You know.
Yeah, I mean,
it's not like a manufacturer rather than just buy an other supplier who has their own.
Yeah,
cost on
I mean,
top.
I think it's okay. I also think it's really encouraging that you can now buy these with Ubuntu on them. It's a slight shame that you didn't combine the two, but you know, it's because you did it a week before they came out.
I did try and call.
Do you not find out all this like exciting shit from inside Canonical beforehand?
No. I have to say, right, I was going to
be disappointed.
But I'm not on the Dell team, am I?
When I was going to buy my Dell laptop, the announcement was going to be made that we're going to ship Ubuntu, and I thought, well, shall I wait or shall I not? And I asked Jono, and he said, nah, they won't be out for at least another year, 18 months. I bought mine, fucking 2 weeks later they started shipping.
Did I say that?
Yeah.
All right.
But, I mean, to be honest, I've got a fat piece of hardware, and I'm really happy with it. But, I mean, the thing that really impresses me about your laptop, not that I've spent that much time looking at it, first of all, it looks great. The hardware seems pretty good in there, and it looks like it's got some really nice gear inside. But also, the price is pretty reasonable.
Pretty cheap, yeah. I mean,
surprising. we were saying earlier that the policy on these things used to be if you wanted Linux on a laptop, you bought one of the business ones because they had decent components in, not cheap components.
And
but yours seems to straddle the gap. You know,
yeah.
The business ones were always sort of, you know, 800 quid or so, and the cheap ones were about 500, 600.
I mean, but I don't know whether Dell has maybe been doing this for a while, but when I was looking around, I was considering either a ThinkPad or there was a Toshiba laptop or there was this one. And I was trying to get a machine that would let me run free drivers. That was the most important thing.
Did you think about going to someone like System 76?
I did, but it was going to be a lot more expensive to buy it.
They certainly seem more expensive to me, but
I did consider waiting until going to, because I'm going to America in a week, and I was thinking about buying one and bringing
it
back.
You get it with, like, all American plugs and stuff.
But the problem is I needed it for my talk at scale, so I didn't want to lug that enormous VAIO over, because my other machine doesn't fucking work, does it, Switch?
You can always borrow a laptop and put it on a USB keyring, your talk. But
yeah, I want. So in summary, it's a nice machine, and I'm impressed that. I haven't tested other distros. I'm assuming Fedora will work pretty much spot on there as well. But it's. I was really pleased that Ubuntu just worked out of the box. Everything worked. Little things like the webcam and the HDMI. I mean, the HDMI port I think would need a little bit of tweaking, but it's pretty much there.
Did the webcam work? Because the wire laptops really
perfectly.
That's wicked.
Yeah, that's cool.
Remember, kids, Dells aren't available in the shops. They've been put online.
Absolutely. Shame about the wireless, but
if you're looking for a mid-price laptop around 600 quid, about $1,000, and you want it to be pre-installed with Ubuntu, go and buy one of these Dells. It's nice.
So join us next week for my name's John O'Bacon. I earn too much and I get to buy new expensive toys every fortnight and talk about them on the show.
You'll want to talk.
Get involved.
New job, boy. Twice your salary. Bring it on.
That's twice my starting salary.
All right.
That's £4.50
now. No, I get to flip the burgers now instead of just doing the buns.
Have you got the key?
I got one star on my badge as well.
So traditionally, one of the ways that companies are meant to make money out of open source is to do support contracts.
Yes. This is true.
This is what everybody always says, make money out of support.
Mm.
So the question is, why really can't you get a home user support contract? Have you ever tried getting one for your own desktop?
Because it seems like most of them are for businesses.
Yeah, and I mean, servers, not a problem.
From what I can tell as well, we were talking about this earlier on, that there doesn't seem to be, well, we didn't look exhaustively, as in we looked at one. And that was canonical.
We don't do research.
We just decided that Red Hat was going to be expensive, and therefore we knew what the answer
for
was.
For everything I know about Red Hat,
I did look on the Red Hat site, and expensive. I couldn't find any pricing information. I
mean, yeah, but it seems you know like it's expensive when they won't tell you how much.
It seems like there's no per-incident support, which is the thing we're interested in. So.
Yeah, it's not just that there's not per-incident support. I mean, I'd love to be able to say to people, when you run into problems, at the moment, you have to say to people, when you run into problems, go and ask an IRC. Because you'll get support from the community. What you actually get is fuck all from the community, right? Sometimes you get help. A lot of the time you don't, because it gets drowned out or because no one answers or whatever.
No one knows.
So it would be nice to be able to say to people, when you buy this, if you're interested in this, pay 50 quid and get a year's worth of ringing up and asking questions or whatever. But a year's support contract seems to be £150 plus. It's quite and that's during the day support. Yeah. I mean, Canonical we looked at was what, 450 quid for a year's?
For 24 hours. Canonical is $250 for 9 to 5, and then I think it was $900 for 24/7. And I don't know how many incidents that limits you to.
And that to me seems like a lot of money.
When
to
you're
suggest
spending as much on the support contract as you are on the computer, then there's kind of something wrong.
So,
you know?
Why aren't people doing this?
Thing is,
maybe there are loads of third party companies that do it. But
to frame it correctly, I don't know whether that. I mean, we've just looked. We've only looked at the Canonical support pricing. I don't know whether that's competitive in the world of support. That might actually be quite cheap, but support's like, I don't know. For a home user, that seems like
We couldn't find anything on the Red Hat.
For a home user, that seems like a reasonable, quite a lot of money. But for a business, that might be quite cheap.
I guess the problem though is that home users tend to log a lot more. I was going to say stupid support but fairly trivial support problems, but they still all take time to deal
with. Was my font's too small and stuff like that. Yeah, I can't change
the font.
I can't read my screen.
You know, but each one of those, they're trivial. Yeah, you ring up somebody, they'll tell you the answer. It'll take about 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But that's still 5 or 10 minutes of a support.
A lot of it as well is the expectations behind Linux. Like, you can imagine someone going out and buying the latest, piece of hardware and plugging it in and it not working. And wanting to know why it doesn't work. And the support officer would say, well, there's no drivers for that. It's not supported in the kernel or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, that would be a useful service for new users as well.
Yeah, part of the point about that is that paid-for support is supposed to be definitive. If I go to an IRC channel and say, I've just plugged this in and it doesn't work, and someone says there's no drivers, I don't necessarily go away thinking, that's because there's no drivers. I go away thinking, that bloke doesn't know of any drivers.
Yeah.
But if I rang up Red Hat and said, I'm using Fedora 8, and I've got this device, and they said, there are no drivers for that device, I go, oh, that's because there aren't any there.
Yeah.
So I believe them. Because you're paying for them, you expect something more definitive.
Authority, don't you?
Also, you always get an answer, even if the answer is, we're not sure. Quite a lot of time, if you ask questions on IRC, or you post to a mailing list, and nobody knows, you never get any responses at all. And people will say, well, that's because no one knew anything. And they're right, but it's really disorienting.
So going back to the original question, why do we think that there isn't support contracts for home users? I mean, Chris made the valid point when we were talking about this earlier on, that distros were doing this years ago, you know.
Yeah, I mean, this is true. 5 years ago, you buy a Red Hat box set, it would come with 30-day support. Mandrake box set, 30-day support, installation support, all that kind of stuff.
And presumably you could extend that support contract if you wanted to.
But they don't do it anymore.
Does it just not make money, you think?
I guess that must be it.
It seems to me, right? I mean, in those days, I don't think there was probably the user base to warrant to fund that kind of operation. To me, it seems like there needs to be a successful end-user support system before anyone's going to go and use it, if you know what I mean. It sounds stupid.
What do you mean?
Chicken and egg problem.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, I see.
There needs to be a known, well-known support service where you go... I mean, for Dell machines, you go to Dell, obviously, and I guess why they've gone through the hassle to certify Ubuntu to work on their machines. But if you're running, I don't know, Fedora or OpenSUSE or something like that, Debian, you're pretty much shit out of luck.
I think that a valid point is that I really do think that the demographic has changed. Like, back when, for example, SUSE were the perfect example, you'd buy a box set and you'd always get 30 days of, I think it was phone support or an email support. And a certain amount of incidents. And I was given a couple of sets. I don't think I ever bought a set, but I was given a couple of sets. And I used the support from Red Hat once. And it was very good. And I never used the SUSE one. But back then, everybody who was using Linux was an expert. Mm-hmm. Or if you weren't an expert already, you were becoming an expert. And part of the reason why you got into it is because you liked you like the thrill of the chase
yeah,
to
the
find
challenge
out
of
you
finding
know,
the answer.
And,
yeah.
But now there's people like my dad using Ubuntu, you know, and it's kind of an axe dad using it. I mean, you know, there's people, normal people that are using Linux.
Well,
very
I'm not sure
scenario.
Anything related to either of you two is normal, but go on.
Well, yeah, I mean, my dad's probably a bad example, purely on the grounds that I don't think I'd ever convince him that it was a better idea to spend 40 quid on a yearly sport contract than just to ring me up at 11 o'clock at night. But,
maybe the people who actually use, the normal people, in quotes, who use Linux are actually people who are related to...
I really do think we've seen the demographic of users change. I think we've seen normal people using it. The fact that, you know, as we talked
but
about...
Normal people who haven't been introduced to it by their sons, husbands, whatever, you know, relations of other sort.
I think as you increasingly see articles in magazines saying... things about Vista. It's a bit of a pain. Why don't you try this? Which I've seen two or three of these in the last sort of 6 months.
Yeah,
ordinary-ish magazines like, you know, PC Plus, saying, why not try out this Ubuntu thing?
Yeah. As it, the Mythbusters guy as well.
Exactly. Mythbusters, perfect example. And I've seen a couple of them saying, use this, there are these things. There's Fedora, there's, you know, you can talk to Novell who you might have heard of. That kind of thing. You're going to get more people who are not introduced to it by their local Linux guru who can then answer questions.
Yeah, maybe so.
So the thing is, I mean, the thing I'd like to know is whether the reason why we don't have these kinds of support options available from companies is because companies are regularly assessing and thinking, you know what, it doesn't make financial sense for us to do that. Or
no one's looked for the last couple of years,
and whether people actually would use it. I mean, our listeners are probably the wrong people to ask because most of the people listening to this show are Linux enthusiasts or free software enthusiasts who like the challenge of fixing shit.
Yeah.
But I wonder how many normal users, how many of the millions of normal users around the world would use something like this? Because it seems like...
The other thing I'd like to... I mean, this is not particularly a Linux thing, but we have the potential to do this right, is that one reason why it might not be profitable is that if you have good support people on the end of the phone, they cost a lot of money.
Yeah,
but I would love to not see. Say Red Hat did this or Novell did this. The first thing they're going to think is, "Oh, we get a lot of these calls. Why don't we put people who just make you go through the checklist first?"
Yeah,
at which point, you know, you save money but trade off customer service, and everybody hates it.
But you can't. Yeah, if it's a choice between employing 1,000 gurus or, you know, 900 trained monkeys and 100 gurus,
well, what I was
then
thinking,
if you have 1,000 gurus, you have to charge people so much more money for their support content, and so less people buy them, and so the economics don't really
get what you pay for.
I understand the economics, absolutely, but the flip side of that is that then you're rating your customers actually enjoying the service at £0.
Well, it's a balance. I don't think that's necessarily the case.
I think, I mean, we were talking about the Microsoft end user support. Was it £40 per incident or something?
The last time I looked, it was $95 per incident, I think.
Yeah, right. So.
And there's going to be a load of people listening to this going, what, you're having a laugh? I think it's $595 per incident.
What I'd imagine you get with that, having never spoken to them, is that most of the calls get taken out by their first line support, which is the people that shield out the easy questions, right? Yeah, you need to click this, you need to click that, you need to go in through this menu and click that and clear out your browser cache or whatever fucking problem of the week is. And then underneath that, you've got the fucking super mega knowledge base of death, which is just answers every fucking this chipset.
I absolutely understand how that
piece of software.
That's how it's supposed to work.
So at that point, you need your expensive tech support guy, but you need the script monkeys at the front to shield out.
I don't think there's anything wrong
fighting through the pain.
Yeah, but there's nothing wrong. Yeah, but otherwise,
I don't see a problem with doing it intelligently. As soon as you have the user explain the question and say, right, one moment, and then pass them over.
And then pass them over.
To the people who know what they're about.
But in that case, why does nobody do that?
What?
If you ring up anyone for technical support, anybody I've ever run, I've run quite a few, firms who make televisions, I've run firms who do internet connections. I've never run a Linux.
ISPs are prime examples of this.
Distributor, but ISPs, televisions, electric and electronic equipment, and you say, I've got this complicated problem, they basically don't believe you and make you walk through.
And I think
you plugged it in? Is it turned on?
I'd say the reason for that is, like, so for example, I called Tiscali, who's my internet provider, my internet service provider, and whenever I ring them, I say immediately, I said, I work in the IT industry, I said, without being arrogant, I know what I'm talking about when it comes to computers. To try and avoid that,
yeah.
They must get thousands of people who say that, thinking that they're like, you know, the village idiot kind of computer
guru. I've got the latest Windows ME.
Yeah. I've just been out and bought, a new printer, so now I know what I'm talking about. And there must be so many people who think they know what they're talking about, but they actually don't. And then it takes them a few minutes to drill down to the fact that, well, yeah, you do actually know what you're talking about, therefore we can kind of talk in a language that we both understand, sort of thing. You know, I reckon you've got to go through that first level, first of all. The key thing is, like Adam says, doing it intelligently. Because you can't employ 1,000 gurus, absolutely. Because apart from anything...
Or 1,000 idiots.
A bunch of gurus who are on that front line, they're going to get bored and leave anyway.
Actually, that point is relevant. Is why is nobody else doing that in our supposed intelligent way in the first place, which is a difficult question to answer. I mean, as soon as your user explains the problem, you know straight away whether they're just a fucking idiot that can't find the problem.
You see, now, that's my problem with it. You'd know that, but the whole point about putting people on first-line support is that a lot of people on first-line support can't necessarily tell the difference. Because there's no one word test to tell someone who knows what they're talking about from someone who doesn't. You have to have someone who knows what they're talking about. Who are the people you talk to first of all in order to be able to make that determination?
You know what we should do? We should get a support officer on the show.
Yeah.
I know a bunch of support officers from Montreal who I could ask. I don't know if they'd come on, but
we spoke to a chap from Red Hat while we were at SkyCon last year. I can't remember his name.
Is that the guy with the long hair?
And short hair. I thought.
There was two or three guys from Red Hat there.
I've always seemed to notice that Red Hat guys have short hair, and Debian guys have long hair, and the Red Hat guys told me it's because they've got jobs.
It's actually just bring us back on topic slightly.
Oh yeah,
but there's a big difference. Red Hat do server support, and there's a difference between server support because you normally guarantee the person meeting up is a sysadmin.
This is another thing I was interested in.
I mean, this is what I do. Server support.
I can imagine it's much more of a.
In which case, you don't have to have idiots on the front desk. You naturally have gurus on your front
desk. And those kind of people are going to be paying big support contracts.
And you charge them as appropriate.
Consumer support must be much more of a hornet's nest than.
Yeah.
It used to be called FreeServe. It's WannaDo now. I remember laughing at FreeServe's adverts saying they'll do technical support over the phone for anyone. I was like, fucking good luck with that one.
I mean,
that job must suck. Yeah.
Yes. That's the problem.
Can you imagine some of the fucking morons?
That's exactly what I said.
I opened the floodgates first line for fucking nutcases. Idiots. And the number of times I had to talk somebody through setting up a fucking email account on Outlook Express.
Yes.
Urging you to do it in your sleep with your eyes shut.
And you hear about all
of these. It'll take you 40 minutes to set up an email account.
You hear about all of these so-called support stories that you don't know whether they're bullshit.
People ringing up going, I can't get Windows to boot properly. It turns out the house is under 18 inches of water or something. Yeah.
There's a power cut.
No, I can believe them. Just to be honest.
A friend of mine told us once, and I don't know if this is true, he claims that this actually happened.
/ digress.
Right? But apparently this woman rung up and said, my computer's not working, it won't start. And he said, okay, well, could you just check the front of this? And she just checked it and was like, yeah, all right. He said, is it plugged into the wall? And she said, yeah, it's plugged in the wall. Is the switch on? Yeah, the switch is on. All this kind of stuff. And then he said, look around the back of the computer and tell me this. And she said, oh, I can't do that. He said, the lights are off.
Yeah, because it's in power.
And apparently, this other person said, the person on the end of the line says, okay, what you need to do is you need to put your computer back in the box and send it back to her, saying, I'm a fucking idiot.
I'm too stupid to own a computer. I don't believe that actually happened to your friend.
I'd love to see that actually happen.
I would.
We need people to send us their stories.
Yeah, we do. Back to the point slightly, I would love to live in a world where I can say to my mate Andy, who runs Linux, pay 50 quid to these people, and then you can ring them up when you've got questions like, how do I unzip something because I can't find anything to do it? And what have I done when I'm trying to open this file, it's called .svg, and it doesn't seem to open anything, what do I do with it? Pay 50 quid. He's the sort of person who would pay £50 a year for that. So write in and tell us why that kind of world can't exist. Because it doesn't.
Lug Radio. Lock in.
A couple of shows ago, we talked about whether distros should tie their server and their desktop versions together.
Yes,
to make them better. And that was the first part of a two-part series about lock-in in the open source world.
That we kind of forgot to do in the last episode.
No, shut up. Right? It was deliberate because we were focusing on KDE.
Yes. Yeah, beard.
Anyway, that's not the point. The second part of the question, which we decided to split into two because they're basically two separate questions under the same heading, is...
Is that why we split it into two?
It is. Because it's in two parts.
Shut up, man.
The second part of the question is, should distributions start doing things in their distribution and then send them upstream afterwards, or should they try and get stuff into upstream and then have it filter back down? I mean, to pick an example, say the people at Fedora think, we can think of a better way of making Nautilus work. Should they think, okay, let's try and get those changes into stock GNOME, so they then filter back down to Fedora, and then everybody gets it at the same time? Hmm. Or should they put it into Fedora first... And then say to upstream where you can take this if you want to. I mean, so essentially kind of a light sort of a fork. You think of the Novell slab as an example of this kind of approach.
We're not talking about the sort of changes you need to do to make... Yeah, changing them file paths and things.
No.
Work with your distro.
We're talking about features which are not specific to your distro. But you think would be useful. Do you try and work with upstream, get them into upstream so everyone gets them at the same time, or do you start innovating in your distribution and then say to upstream you can take it if you want to, which is essentially forking the project, but it means you can deliver it faster?
I don't think anyone would ever say that the ideal solution is that you always develop stuff upstream, I think. I think the right way you should do it is to do it upstream. But the reality is that often
upstream isn't always going to want to do what you want to do.
Yeah, they're not going to head in the direction that you want to head in, or they're not going to accept your patches or whatever.
But is that not a reason to only work with the upstream? You know, if they're not going to accept your changes, then you're going to maintain your changes out of tree.
Yeah.
To use the jargon. For like forever, basically.
Yeah.
You have to keep changing these.
And that's increasingly what a lot of distros do. They have these massive patch sets that get ported from version to version.
Is that not a really bad thing?
Well, it's one of the
just the amount of effort it takes.
This is the point of the question.
This is the reason why most distros generally follow upstream.
For example, this is something I was looking at recently. Fedora have been backporting Xen to kernels, to old porting features from older kernels to their current kernels or something like that for the history of Xen in Fedora. And all of a sudden they just said, look, we're not going to do this anymore because it's so much hard work. We're just going to live with older kernels if you want to run Xen.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. You so end up with these huge
that you just can't do it.
I suppose this is precisely the point. If you think, yes, it's a lot of effort maintaining this stuff out of tree, maintaining your own fork of upstream, then, yeah, it is a lot of work and it is a lot of hassle. But the alternative is you think, this would really help our users. You talk to upstream and they say, we don't like it for reasons you disagree with. You are then stuck with either forking and maintaining it until the end of time or doing without it.
Yeah, I suppose it depends. This, to me, the problem's in two parts. One is whether we say people should be developing features, whether they should aim to develop features upstream or do them themselves, right, and keep them in the distro. That's one aspect. But the other aspect is, of course, is distros diverge away from the intentions of upstream? So, for example, the good example here is SUSE.
Yeah.
You know, GNOME. Stock GNOME does not ship with the slab by default, but they felt that for their distro, it would be a unique feature, it would be different, it would be attractive to their user
base. It's very user visible as well. Yeah. It's not like saying we're going to change the way that Nautilus does thumbnails.
So the question is it in the spirit of open source to do that kind of stuff?
I think at the time a lot of people bitched because Novell went away and then came back with the thing finished and said, this is what we're going to do, here's the code.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of people complained about that.
Which they've done quite a bit.
Yeah,
these
I believe
big
so.
Code dumps. They do that extra.
And that upsets people. I'm not much of a developer, and this is my naive view of the way I think it ought to work, is that you should, when obviously someone's going to have an idea and maybe they prototype it up or you do some screenshots or mock-ups or whatever, or you string some code together that makes it kind of hang together, and you say, this is what we're thinking of doing and we're going to do this. Mm. And ask you, at that point you say to the upstream project, is this something that you're interested in? and they either go yes or no.
I mean, that's the ideal way of doing things, but of course it doesn't work that way.
No.
And the thing is, every distro, bar none, wants to set themselves different to the pack. Every single one. I'd say the exception there is Debian. But every distro, I can guarantee you that Ubuntu, Fedora, and SUSE will all want to set themselves apart from the pack to attract users. It's only natural. But to do that within the kind of the community is very difficult.
The reason I think this is an interesting question is not from a pure philosophical point of view. It's that if you, there's this kind of mental pressure on people to work closely with upstream, to not do what Novell did with the slab and go, we're going in a different direction. If you like it, come along. If you don't, then you don't like it, fine, we'll maintain it forever. There's this kind of pressure on people not to do that. I mean, you said, you know, Novell have done this lot, code dumps. Like, that's a bad thing, you shouldn't do that, you should work with upstream.
No, I wasn't saying that in necessarily a bad way, I'm just saying that they've done it a lot.
But the point here is, there's a lot of stuff where people have said, wouldn't it be great, you know, do innovative things, diverge a bit, get away from the way we're going and try stuff out. And we've said, you know, one of the flexibilities of open source is that you can do this kind of innovation, but in practice, nobody is.
Well, actually, it depends, because when people...
The slab surprised me.
When distros do it, it's frowned upon. I never really thought about this. When distros do it, it's kind of frowned upon, right?
It is.
But when you do it at an upstream level, it isn't. I mean, look at all the different kernel trees.
Yeah.
You know, and look at, I mean, things without wanting to sing the, you know, the Ubuntu line, but look at things like Bazaar with distributed version control. It's really easy.
Hang on. What I don't understand is when you say doing it at an upstream level isn't frowned upon, if all these different kernel trees isn't frowned upon. If the GNOME project, the GNOME project can't go in two different directions.
Yep.
Right? So they have to go in one direction, at which point it's not a fork. And anybody who says, I'm going to, at an upstream level, do something different in GNOME, then you're talking about forking all of GNOME.
I think the difference is, though, at an upstream level, individual GNOME developers do their own thing, and, you know, it's, yeah, technically, I suppose, lots of little forks are all heading off, and then they decide, that's the way to do it, that's the right answer, we'll use that, and it kind of merges back in.
Whereas the distro level, I don't agree with you. The
distro can say, we're going to fork, and, you know, all of our users are going to end up using it.
Fundamentally, the distro is deploying software, whereas upstream isn't. Upstream's creating software be deployed.
If SUSE say we want to use the slab, say, you know, then they ship it and millions of people end up using it. And whether it's a good solution, the right solution, the best solution, doesn't really matter. SUSE have the power to take over this
thing. One of the interesting things about this is, yeah, I mean, individual distributors, individual upstream developers, I mean, if you look at Alex Gravely working on Gimme.
I was going to say,
for example, that's a perfect example of building an application on top of existing GNOME or building Tomboy or whatever. But to pick one of my pet examples, if you wanted to get rid of file pickers and use Nautilus for everything, when you save something, you drag an icon and drop it into Nautilus. You can't do that as a developer. You can't go into, because it involves touching everything. You have to be a distribution to do that.
Yeah.
But if it's frowned on by distributions,
you can put together a prototype and say, hey, why don't we do this? And it's only a small fork. And then if people like it, they pick it up and they do the rest of the work.
So the idea is all you can do is you can say, this is how this feature would work if we did it, and try and convince people of the idea.
Yeah.
Rather than say to me, well, here is working desktop.
This was my naive point of view as well. Whether it's naive or not, I don't know. But this was the way I thought it ought to work.
I mean, the thing is, my point in terms of the difference between upstreams and distros is that when a distro takes something that isn't the perceived norm of the upstream, it's sometimes frowned upon by some people, right?
Yeah.
So the example there is, of course, the slab with Novell, right? That was frowned upon by a lot of GNOME people because it was different to the stock GNOME that the GNOME ships with their source.
And it looks shit.
Right? Now, the thing is...
Sorry.
The thing is that... But with look at the kernel. I mean, you have Linus's tree, and then you've got all of these other trees, and then you've got things like Gimme, which is an alternative to the paneling GNOME, and things like that. And those things are kind of encouraged. You know, these things are encouraged because I think fundamentally they're not, like Chris says, they're not deployed in front of millions of users. Like Alex Gravely, his Gimme panel thing is only of interest to GNOME enthusiasts. Most normal people will never see that unless it appears in their distro.
I'm thinking about more kind of infrastructural changes. I mean, pick a couple of examples, right? I would love to see programs on Linux not remember file names, but remember inodes for things like, you know, your recent documents menu or whatever. So if I move a file, it doesn't forget where it is.
Yeah.
You know, if I say, if I save a file and then I move it into a different folder, the bloody application should remember that file because there's a unique number for it, the inode, but it doesn't use it, it uses a path name because that's what Windows uses, because that's all Windows has got.
So,
right, that's something that would be jolly difficult for anyone without the resources of a distro to change because you have to patch the world to do it. Second example, Alex Larson doing GIO, the replacement for GVFS. This is, sorry, in-depth GNOME stuff here. GNOME VFS, which is the file system layer that lets GNOME applications talk to SSH servers to talk to the file system itself. Yeah. He's replacing it with a thing called GIO, which is more efficient and does everything better. And he's basically saying, I'm hacking on this and it's going to become the way GNOME does it.
Yeah.
Because he's already a core GNOME developer. Doing that kind of thing out of the tree would be jolly to do.
If OpenSUSE were us, if Novell were to do that, or Red Hat said, we're going to do it this way, everyone's going to go crazy, aren't they?
I mean, some distros do patch to absolute oblivion.
That would be hysterically difficult to do if you were going to do it and then get to the end of the core GNOME team say, no, we don't like it. Then you're not going to motivate many people to do things like rewrite the entire file system layer to be better if there's a risk that people are going to say no at the end.
Well, the thing is, I mean, trying to keep the discussion relatively focused, because instead of just, you know, the ability to get features in an upstream project is quite broad.
Yeah.
Looking at, I mean, when we started talking about this, it seemed largely from the perspective of distributions.
Yeah.
Feel that it's right for distributions to digress away from upstream as much? What do we think?
In a kind of way of answering that, I mean, I've only got you here to ask about this. Have you any idea how far an Ubuntu GNOME desktop differs from a stock GNOME desktop?
I've compiled a stock GNOME desktop, and it's massively different to everything that's deployed.
Interestingly, though.
But at a configuration level. I mean, in terms of themes and icons and stuff like that.
The interesting point about that is, how much does an Ubuntu GNOME desktop differ from a Fedora GNOME desktop?
That's where I was heading.
Not very much. Not that different, are they? Distros all patch in quite similar ways, but they're all applying the same set of patches to stock GNOME.
We're kind of back to a question that we were talking about last time, strangely enough. It's kind of like, if you are patching your GNOME desktop, so it's radically different. If Ubuntu is patching there, so it's radically different from the Fedora one, and so you can't then move between from one to the other without major hassles. That's got to be a bad thing, surely.
Well,
you know,
I mean,
if you can't take your application that works on Fedora and take it to Ubuntu and, you know...
Well, right now, I mean, the thing is that it's not patched to the level where you couldn't do that. I mean,
I know, but using that hypothetically.
I mean, you could theoretically...
You could do that.
You know,
I mean,
Ubuntu, as an example, could decide that it's going to use a completely new configuration system.
Yeah.
And not going to use .dot files. And every application is going to be patched, or there's going to be some bridge that ports between .dot files and this configuration system, you know. And that would be difficult,
I mean, if you did it, though, as a distribution, surely that's got to be a bad thing. That's the kind of the extreme example of what is
moving between distros, you know, in where configuration files are stored.
But I think that's the point. At the moment, because we want it to be easy for people to move in between distros, and we're all Linux together and all that.
Yeah.
So we're not, distros aren't diverging very much in order to try and keep that idea. But in practice, it is quite different. If you move from Ubuntu to Fedora, you can't download packages from the same place. And you can't, if you download a program from, I mean, a perfect example came up today, the VMware Workstation tools, available as an RPM and as a tar.gz. Yeah. There's no deb.
It's the same with Flash, Adobe Flash as well.
Precisely. So we're getting all the deficits of being different.
But that's a packaging issue. Packaging is
bad. It's not just packaging, it's configuration files are in a different place. An application that's compiled may not, because we don't have a Linux desktop platform to compile things against.
Yeah, I mean,
So we get all the deficits of them being different, but you don't get any of the benefits. Like, if you say, well, if we're going to be different anyway, then screw it, we can do this stuff.
But I don't think there's that many deficits. You're not talking about, those aren't serious deficits. Yeah, you have to repackage stuff if you move, you know, to an application from Debian to Red Hat. You have to repackage it, and it's a bit of a pain in the ass, but it's not actually that hard. It's not significant rewriting of code. It's that kind of level of problem.
I think, looking at the original question, my personal view is that I think that the benefits of a distribution diverging away from upstream to a small to a reasonable degree, not to levels of insanity, but diverging to a reasonable degree. Then the benefits of that, and importantly, not only sacrificing that divergence from upstream, but also the divergence from other distributions. Yeah. I think the benefits outweigh the disadvantages. Like, I think that moving between distributions is not as important as keeping with upstream. I think keeping with upstream is generally a nice thing to do. It's what you'd want to do. But fundamentally, the purpose of an upstream project is to provide software that is deployed in distributions. That's basically the way things work. Very, very few upstream projects tend to act themselves as distros. You know, they provide software that is meant to be run on other systems. Now, I'm not talking here applications. I'm talking here kind of like furniture. You know, like GNOME is a piece of furniture that's in Ubuntu. I'm not talking about... I'm not talking about OpenOffice. I'm not talking about Firefox.
But we're talking...
They're different. You want those applications to make sure that they work largely the same on every distro.
Infrastructure application.
Infrastructure stuff, I think, is there to be customized, to be used. It's kind of like saying, you know, it's kind of like buying a house and saying you can't paint it, you know? It's like, you want to be able to customize it and so it works well for that particular distro, because each distro is different.
Yeah, and they're normally a matter of taste, aren't they?
Yeah, and I think that it's the benefits of diverging away.
But I mean,
when you can secure that kind of, because there's loads of subtle things like, you know, like consistent tabs across applications. You know, different distros. You know, if you look at tabs in Firefox, they're different to tabs in GTK. And
I don't see any problem with diverging, even if it's significantly visible feature like the slab. So long as you make your kind of statement of intent up front and you say, this is what we're planning to do. If you want to do it, come and help us. If you don't, then we want to hear why. And the slab is a prime example, because that happened the opposite way around. It's like, we've done this. Here's the code. I don't see why you can do that. I mean, if, as you said earlier, if you want to maintain this change set for the rest of its eternity, then cool. This is what makes you happy. If your distro being different, I don't see any problem with any distro going, right, we want to do it this way. A significant feature change, as long as you say, we're going to do this. And you invite the debate, because sooner or later, the conclusion of this debate is going to be that everybody agrees it's a good thing to do or it's a bad thing to do.
My nightmare scenario is basically that Linux becomes like Unix is now, where basically you started off in one place, and it was all good and it all worked, and then you've got... It diverges into Solaris and HPUX and AIX, and they're not compatible.
Yeah, an important thing related to that is making sure applications can work on those systems, which is why the LSP and things like that are important.
Yeah, I mean, my point is I'm caught on precisely that dilemma between the devil and the deep blue sea, because if you came to me and said, what are the 10 things you'd like to see fixed about the Linux desktop, an awful lot of them are kind of low-level infrastructure-y stuff. Things like making applications remember inodes, getting rid of file pickers, making it so you can deploy an application by being one executable file rather than having packages. They're all kind of big stuff which has to be done at a distribution level by someone with the resources of a distribution.
Yeah, they have to be done across...
It's not something that I can sit down and fix without recompiling the entire world to work the way I want it to, and I don't have the resources.
But if one distro does that and nobody else does...
Then you've got 1980s Unix. That's my worry, that will fragment just like they did, and they took... You know, they could have dominated the world. They had their shit together at a point when the Windows people didn't. And what they did was they fell to infighting and it all fell apart.
Fucked it all up.
And I'm exactly like you. I'm terrified that will happen if we die. But it feels to me
it's
like
unlikely.
We don't, it doesn't feel like we can, we've got the freedom to innovate very much, because you've got to make sure that the whole rest of the world comes along with you. And so we can't do anything. I keep banging on about how people should do unique stuff just because it's unique, just to be different in case it works.
Unique stuff without the major fragmentation.
But this was the thing. This is the thing, is that if you looked at Linux, let's say 10 years ago, when people talked about Linux 10 years ago, people talked about having different trees and stuff like that. It was generally relatively frowned upon, because it felt like forking. The concept was forking. Whereas now, I mean, and admittedly, a lot of this I've heard through some friends of mine who work in the Bazaar team, in the company and upstream as well. But they, that's all about branching and trying shit out and then merging back in. And the whole idea of distributed revision control, obviously, is that you have the freedom to produce patch sets. And the great thing about that is it allows people to innovate. And I get the impression that...
But it only allows one person to innovate at a time. It still wouldn't solve Axe's problem of changing across sort of multiple different projects.
Well, yeah, I mean, fundamentally, if fundamental structural changes like that have to be part of a strategy for the upstream. Every upstream needs to have a strategy about what they want to do. So using Axe's example of watching iNode, that is something that fundamentally the GNOME project needs to say, this is what we're going to do, because this is something that touches so many different things, so therefore we need to move together. That's more difficult than, let's say, choosing a different menu or a different topic or whatever.
Yeah. It's not switching one application for another. It's doing things that touch all applications.
But I like the fact that we're seeing, and admittedly a lot of this is down to people such as the Kernel Project who pushed a lot of this forward, first of all, and people who work on all the many different distributed revision control systems, is that people are encouraging the idea of people playing with this kind of stuff and then building packages.
I think the danger is if this kind of stuff doesn't happen at any level, then you're just going to stagnate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It has to happen somewhere. I think, to me, it just needs to be that you make your statement of intent. We want to go this way. Are you coming?
But I think a significant problem here is the expectations of the open source community are completely incorrect at times, where a lot of people in the open source community, and we've all been guilty of this, are of the view that whenever anything happens, it should benefit everybody. And the code being available itself is not acceptable. That's not enough. It's the fact that it's got to work conveniently for everybody.
It's got to be changed for the good for everybody. Yeah.
So, for example, I mean, Novell got a lot of shit for dumping XGL, right? They dumped this massive chunk of code on the community, and they got a lot of shit for it. And I can imagine from an ex-hacker's perspective, there's this massive chunk of code that's got to be merged, and it's going to take time.
And the 6 months of work that you've just done that's now broken, if you want to include this.
But then you've also got to look at from Novell's side. They've invested a lot of money, a lot of time, producing this thing that's, in fairness, revolutionised a significant chunk of what we can offer to people.
I mean, you have to look at their arguments, really, for why they went... They've got this fantastic idea, and then they went away and just did it in private, and then they came back when they were happy.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you said earlier on is it's how you go about it.
I think you've got to offer
it. You've got to do it out in the open.
You've got to include upstream to start with, hey guys, we're doing this. I mean, XGL and the slab and those kind of things are prime examples.
Interesting parallel with what Apple did with WebKit, which that's what they were doing. They took it to open source project. They did, hundreds of thousands of lines worth of revisions on it and just dumped it all in one big dump and just said, here, have that. And they were slammed for it, and quite rightly so, because it was just impossible to merge it back. And Novell basically did exactly the same thing.
And I think it's happening less. I mean, if you look at a lot of specific distro work that's going on and upstream work, they're tending to do it more and more out in the open, because the Novell got an awful lot of shit.
The thing is with XGL, I mean, what I was saying about XGL is, I mean, why did they go away and just do it in private? Is it, do you think...
The reason why they did it is the reason why a lot of distros do this kind of stuff, is because they want the upper hand.
You steal a six-month march. I mean,
do you really think that's what it is? Or do you think it is that they thought, well, if we get too many hands on deck, it's just going to turn into a mess?
Well, you've got to ask yourself, what competitive advantage can a distro get? The only competitive advantage a distro can have in the way open source works is a time advantage.
It should be first.
That's the only advantage you've got. Because fundamentally, I mean, a good example, right? Ubuntu shipped the first Easy Codec installation thing. That's something that we developed. And we got a time advantage in that. We developed it all out in the open. But it wasn't really talked about very loudly, because it happened in Ubuntu land. It wasn't something that people were shouting about. And then, of course, next release of Fedora, it's deployed. And this happens all the time. And the shit that's gone into Fedora has been in Ubuntu. And vice versa. And it's... You only get that time advantage. The thing is that if you remember around that time of I think it was NLD. It wasn't just XGL. They were touting a lot of new shit that was going into their release. They had a big splash and BrainShare. They had this big presentation. All this kind of, and all this shit. They were going for the big time based splash.
I mean, your interesting thing there. Take Easy Codec Buddy as an example, right? You weren't pushing that upstream. Canonical weren't pushing it. It was kind of, we're developing this. You can pay attention to it if you want to, but it's up to you, upstream people, to come and get it from us. Which is precisely not what we said they should be coding.
I think it's fine to develop stuff out in the open. I don't think you necessarily have to have a PR agent to talk about it. I think so long as you are providing an open code repository and preferably some roadmap about what you're doing, And I think so long as you're developing out in the open, that's in my opinion the preferred route you do it.
So if Novell had done exactly what they did with XGL, but there was a public subversion repository that they were committing to,
I wouldn't have an issue with it.
Right. Okay.
Because fundamentally, it'd be nice if Dave Reeveman at the time contacted the X team. Like,
well, this is what I was thinking.
And said, you know, we're doing this, but we prefer it if you, you know, we're trying to have this time, we're trying to get an advantage, but we want to keep you clued in. I don't think any of the X developers would have had an issue with that, because fundamentally no one really cares, other than X people, about what's going on in X.
I mean, the interesting question, it's a kind of a philosophical shift. Instead of saying, we will make sure we push this to upstream, you say, upstream, here it is. Now you have to pull it from us. Mm. It puts the onus on upstream to pay attention to what their downstreams are doing.
I don't see an issue with that, because fundamentally it's a contribution up to upstream. You know, in the same way that if I produce a patch for the kernel, I shouldn't expect the kernel community to do the legwork to come and get my patch. I should say,
a patch is different to XGL though, isn't it?
Well, yeah. It is. I mean, it's
2 years of somebody's hard work that's wasted from just having it all kind of broken by somebody's code dump, isn't it?
Well, the thing is, well, we should be careful because we don't know the technical implementation of XGL. No. I mean, I can tell you, it was actually relatively modular.
Right.
But it was a big fucking chunk of code.
Yeah. You know? That's the thing.
And, I mean, I think the moral of the story here is that code dumps are a bad thing. You should develop in the open where possible. It's how much you interact with upstream to let them know about that is the key thing. And I believe that there should be a minimum amount. You should at least interact with them to a degree.
You think they should be aware of what you're doing.
But you shouldn't be necessarily having to blog about it and shout and bawl about it.
But you think keeping upstream notified is enough? You shouldn't try. You don't necessarily need to make sure that your changes happen in upstream. You just you tell upstream you're doing it, and then if they want to make it happen in upstream, that's up to them.
Well, I think there's a bare minimum. That's the nice.
I think if you make, if you, as I keep saying, if you make upstream aware of what you're planning to do, and then it's up to them if they want to listen to you or not.
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
You have to do that, that's, but you also have to be prepared to work with them.
No,
if they
it's
say,
not a
well,
fork.
It's,
that's what a fork is.
You're inviting
is.
Them to join in.
If they come back to you and say, I mean, yeah, we kind of like what you're doing, but we just, yeah, as upstream, we'd rather you tweaked it that direction and you take that on board, then, yeah, so there's backwards and forwards.
Yeah, I mean,
then
fine. Exactly. It's not all
if you just
one.
Say, this is what we're doing, and if you don't like it, stuff you.
Yeah.
Then I think that's
bad.
A bad thing.
You shouldn't do that.
That's
should,
a fork.
The thing is, though, is I think you should at least make sure that your code is available publicly. That might not necessarily be on the upstream source control system, but your code should be available publicly, and you should work at every step you can with upstream.
You see, as I understand it, and I'm not 100% sure I understand this right, but I'm fairly sure I do, the upstream X.org team think that XGL is the wrong way to go.
Yeah.
It puts GL at the wrong level of the X.
And this is the reason why I don't want to talk about XGL too much of an example.
So the point is, when I said if they developed it in public, would you be okay with that? The X.org people would have said, don't do it that way. And Novell would have said, we're doing it that way.
Now, in that
reasons, and if they had came to a conclusion.
That's what a fork is.
That, to me, is the point of doing it in the open, because sooner or later, the conclusion is going to be either this is a good thing to do or it's a bad thing to do, at which point you have to decide whether you're going to do it without the support of upstream.
Whether you're going to fork or whether you're going to fall in line.
Well, effectively, that is what happened. It forked, went away, and then came back.
The thing is, so many good things have come about because people have... I mean, XGL's a perfect example, you know. At first, there was a lot of shit flying around about it. But from what I gather, XGL is the dominant 3D GL backend thing for X.
I don't think so. AOGLX is everywhere.
Is AOGLX what's shipped for most distros?
Yes.
Oh, right, okay.
As I understand it.
So, I mean, using that as an example.
Including Ubuntu, I believe.
Yes.
I don't know.
As I understand it, Ubuntu is ARGLX. Fedora is ARGLX.
I'm aware that my position may well be quite naive. So that's what I think the situation is.
The interesting thing is, I mean, I think you, Jono, you seem to be seeing a change in who holds the whip hand. It's not upstream that gets to decide what happens and distros implement it. It's now more distros who get to decide the direction that it goes in, and upstream should kind of follow along and take the best
not
bits
at all.
To make.
Not at all.
That's the way it seems to be coming across.
That's not what I'm saying at all.
No, I think that might be true, because I think the names of distros are now far bigger. You know, the fact that it's Ubuntu is now far, not more important than it being Linux, but it's kind of a significant chunk.
Yeah.
And so at that stage, Ubuntu have more power over the upstream. And same with Fedora and, you know, whoever.
I mean,
that's changed over the last few years, I think.
What I'm saying is that it's a responsibility of both distros and upstream to work together. right? It's unfair for a distro to dump a shitload of code on an upstream. But it's also unfair for an upstream to bitch about anything that a distro develops on top of their upstream. It's a balance. So what I'm saying is the balance of that is that a distro, and this is, I'm not saying necessarily that Ubuntu or anybody else does it this way, but in my personal view, the way it should work is that if a distro is going to develop custom features that step outside the parameters of the published roadmap for that upstream, then the distro should at least make sure that they interact with the upstream, make them aware of it, and make sure that the code's available. Then at least the upstream's aware of it. Whether they want to make use of it or not is a different issue. Yes, but yeah. They should work at every level to work with the upstream. Because a lot of underlying structural stuff can work at the same level. But then at some point it will diverge. And to make sure that it's modular, and to make sure that the code is in a patch that form and a patch set that's accessible. In the same way that with Ubuntu, the start of an Ubuntu release cycle, we sync with Debian, right? That we sync with with a Debian repository, and then we merge changes into the packages, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We make patches available to Debian for those merges. And some Debian people have said, you know, these aren't useful in certain ways. And in my mind, it's our responsibility to try and make those patches useful to Debian. I mean, that's a little different because Debian are downstream to us, you know?
Are they?
No, they're not.
They're upstream to you, sure.
They're upstream to you. You're a derivative of them.
Hang on a second. Yeah,
we're downstream to you.
You are downstream to Debian.
We're downstream. Yeah, so the thing is, but we're fundamentally, we're working with Debian, right? And I believe that it's as much of a responsibility for us to work with them as them to work with us.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that anyone's got the whip hand. There should be an acknowledgement of both sides to work together.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, listeners, we've got lots and lots of stuff we want to hear from you about, and we're going to go through some of these bits and pieces right now. So first of all, we've got a new segment that's going to be coming up in the next couple of shows called the Lug Radio Krypton Factor. The Krypton Factor being a shitty 80s TV show in which people went on with various feats of physical and mental daring. Okay,
in luminous jumpsuits, I believe.
Yeah. And,
which we will be wearing.
And Americans, let us know if you had that show. Anyway, what we'd like you to do is we'd like you to send us an email to show@lugradio.org with things that you'd like all four of us to do at the same time. So this could be, as an example.
Now, hang on. These are things where they want to see us competing. Who's best
yes,
at
competing.
Them.
Yes.
If you want us to do some kind of thing all together, then we're not interested.
Yeah, you can go to...
no tag team efforts here.
So the plan is, as a simple example, setting up a mail server for me, Ak, Adam and Chris is going to be completely different for each one of us. So that'll be... And what we're going to do is we're going to do whatever task we think would be interesting and we'll record it and for possible comedic outcomes. So send in your ideas of things that we could do. Keep them reasonable, you know. Setting up a Beowulf cluster is going to be difficult for all of us,
yeah.
Right?
Yes. Apart from Chris. Parachuting is probably out as well.
So send us in your ideas to show@lugradio.org and we'll see what's what. Next!
Obviously, Lug Radio Live in the US is going to happen.
More details on that later on.
Apparently. but we're looking for people to be speakers, we're looking for people to do buffs.
Exhibitors. I expect exhibitors are going to be my problem sooner or later, isn't it?
Hopefully soon rather than later, slack boy.
So if you have ideas for talks you'd like to do or anything like that, lugradio.org/live and click on call for papers.
While we're on exhibitors, I'd just like to point out, if you've got something cool to show us, something interactive, something that we can get in climb into... like I don't know, fucking game simulator running
something
Linux.
Where something, people walking past will go, wow, that's cool.
Yeah, something that
sleeping
people
back.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking for you to come and exhibit at Lug Radio Live USA.
Bring it Linux up. Powered sleeping bag.
That sounds awful. I've already forgotten my thing that I was supposed to actually report. Yes, don't forget you can send us a suggestion for the show on the Lug Radio forums. It's forums.lugradio.org. You can send us emails at show@lugradio.org. What was the other thing?
Voicemails.
You can send us voicemails by going to lugradio.org/contact and finding the telephone number on there.
Because we can't remember it.
No, we can't.
We can never remember it. That's why I wrote it down. And the final thing we'd like you to send us, what are we calling this? Call versus care.
Yes. Yes, indeed. It's got to have a good name.
We keep coming up with things where we think, we should talk about this. A perfect example is Nokia buying Trolltech. Right, but what it boils down to is there's not enough there for us to talk about, really. And we essentially boil it down to that's cool or we don't care about that, and that's it.
Yeah.
So, send us things and where you'd like to know whether we think it's cool or whether we don't care about it, and we'll tell you what we think about it.
We'll have a micro-discussion which will result in cool or care.
And generally give them short shrift and insult you.
It may not be quite that micro. But things where you'd like to hear whether we like it or not. A perfect example of this is, you know, we did the fish discussion earlier, you know.
Yep.
So if you've got a project you'd like to hear us talk about or something that's happened in the news, then write to us and let us know.
It would help if it didn't involve learning an entirely new shell, to be honest.
So as usual, you know, suggestions for all of this kind of stuff to show@lugradio.org, yep, or to forums.lugradio.org.
It's time for emails.
Woo! Woo! Woo!
Pretty enthusiastic there, people.
We try our best. It's late.
So, speak of the emails,
proctologist.
They're bound to appear.
Thank you. I've got one here from Adam Thayer. He's talking about
is he related to Leo Thayer?
Strangely enough, he doesn't say. He doesn't outline his entire family history in the email.
He's got a fat tongue.
And you, Jono, were slagging off the fact that K3B beeps at you when it's burning the CD.
I don't need rewarding for a CD burning.
He says, "Hey guys, just thought I'd weigh in on using audio prompts, especially in K3B. I often have burning sessions when I'm burning multiple CDs in one day and use the audio prompts so that I can watch TV while my computer is working. I know when to pop another blank disc in because it beeps at me." So there you go. So it does have some use.
Not much, though.
There is somebody who thinks it's a really good thing.
Okay.
Nobody in this room, obviously. But
no, the blank expressions. Whatever. No, thank you for letting us know that, Leo.
If only K3B crashed less often, it would actually be useful, which is a fair point.
Thank you, Adam Thayer. Realistically, we can say at this point, face bothered, see this face, am I bothered?
Am I bothered? Your shipment of fail...
has arrived.
Is in the post.
Is in the post.
The point is, I think, we are not the entire user community. There are other people who have different needs.
There are plenty of wrong people out there in the world, yes.
Everybody's got needs.
Really, just a pair of arseholes, aren't you?
Hence like the picture.
If it doesn't affect you,
the
two old questions,
Sesame Street. The Muppet Show.
Muppet Show.
On you go.
Is it me? Right, I'm going to cheat here. I'm going to read two out in one go.
Good grief.
Maybe three, actually. First of all, shut up. That wasn't what I was going to say. First of all, Carl Simons has emailed in to tell us about Linux Fest Northwest is happening. It doesn't actually say when, but if you want to know more about it, have a look at Linux Fest Northwest. Oh man, that reeks. Sorry. There's also some guy who's wrote in.
What, the festival?
Yeah.
Carry on.
You know full well what I'm on about. You gents asked for Kovmo, I think is his name, but I think the less said about that, the better. So you guys asked about fish jokes in the last show. I don't have any one. I thought I'd drop you a note just for the halibut.
That's
awful.
not even a good joke.
Very funny.
And I'm going to apologise to him straight away. David Hills, I'm sorry, I don't have time to read all your email, but he emails in to tell us that he bought an MSI Megabook. That's a laptop, by the way.
Sounds like a burger.
Yeah. And it runs Ubuntu on it absolutely fine, and he was very happy and very surprised, I think.
Good stuff.
Sorry.
Cool.
Mr. Langridge.
Email from Eddie Muliono, who's actually speaking at Lug Radio Live in the US.
Bring it up. More on that later.
But he sent us a completely separate email saying, "I haven't heard any mention of Frets on Fire, which is an open source Guitar Hero lookalike written in Python." Which it is, apparently. I've seen a video of it, and it looks pretty cool.
It's wicked.
In lieu of a guitar controller, one can rock out with their keyboard, and it can import songs from Guitar Hero 1 and Guitar Hero 2. He comes up with the idea of having a Friends on Fire competition during Lug Radio Live.
Friends on Fire?
No, Frets on Fire. Yeah. Although Friends on Fire sounds like a much better competition.
You might all get friends on Facebook, and then just pour petrol over them and torch them.
Set them all on fire. Frets on Fire competition during Lug Radio Live. Now, we'd thought of that idea, strangely enough.
Idea, yes.
Indeed.
So let us know if you think it'd be a good idea.
Frets on Fire is very, very cool. Very polished game
it
as well.
It's good, actually, doesn't it?
I've been digging Guitar Hero 3, and it is very cool. And apparently the controller does work with it. Anyway, email from Brad Phipps. Saying, "Hi guys, I'm an Ubuntu user, but I like to tinker and try out other distros. So when I heard a review of Fedora 8, I thought I'd give it a go. Here's the tip to share with your listeners. don't type in fedora.org like I did. Okay? Fedora is actually at fedoraproject.org. Fedora.org is apparently dedicated to young Japanese women who like to lick their cats proctoring, in brackets, anus. When I first saw that website, I thought it was fucking hilarious. But then I thought, how many people went there looking for Fedora and then gave up because of that? Probably the Fedora Project should try and buy that domain name for themselves.
You know what? Every fucking pervy geek is typing fedora.org right now, don't you?
Yeah, I went there when I saw that email and it is hilarious. It's just this Japanese girl licking a cat. It's not like licking a cat's ass, from what I could tell, but...
I checked research. just before we recorded.
Is that like the guy from the Who's research on this
For
show,
God's sake, I spent ages saying, can someone look into App Armor so we can talk about it? Nothing. Japanese women licking cats, both of you have gone and looked. I have not looked at this.
There was lots of photos of Japanese girls licking their cats, but only one appeared to be in any way twinkling with its arsehole.
Twinkling. Is that like twittering? He also says the
show sticking your tongue up someone's ass. Yeah, that's exactly what it's like.
Now we have our intro a bit before the music. He says the show is great, keep up the good work, I love you guys, but you know, not in a gay way.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
I've had an email from David Goodger, who's basically pimping PyCon 2008.
God, it sounds like Nadja.
PyCon 2008, Chicago, March the 14th to the 16th. Go to us.pycon.org.
Okay.
If you're interested.
Yeah, we had another chap pimper thing, Northwest Linux.
Yeah, Linux. That was quite lusty.
All right, cool.
Cool or care? Do we care about that?
PyCon.
UK one was good.
But unless they don't pay my airfare, I don't really care.
Yeah. They actually say something like, we'd love to see you there, in a kind of, if you pay for it yourselves kind of way.
You just say, wish you could join us, good at Luck with Luck Radio Live in San Francisco.
Thank you very much. People, we hope to see you at Luck Radio Live in San Francisco. You are unlikely to see us at PyCon, considering it's in Chicago. Yeah,
and our conference is better than yours. Anyway. I'm not joking.
Harsh.
Okay. I got one here from Jim Shaver, which amused me. And it's not going to make him any happier that I'm laughing at his name, given the first line is, hey guys, I used to hate the show, but this season is so good so far. He just wanted to comment on something about piracy in the last show. One of your contributors claimed that they were against piracy of smaller software shops' products, but not really against software that was solidly established.
That would be Jono, I don't mind stealing bacon.
I like bacon.
You wouldn't steal a handbag, so why would you steal software?
Right, Jim Shaver says,
Does he shave a gym?
Well, I thought about that.
maybe he shaves in the gym.
Maybe that's his job.
maybe just Jim is what he calls it.
So poor fucking fat guy with a hairy ass
goes into the gym and then gets shaved, runs 100 laps to the track and then bends over and says, okay, Mr. Jim Shaver.
So,
I'll have a crack sack of back wax, please.
Jim Shaver says, I would put forward that if Microsoft had found a bulletproof way to stop piracy, that this would actually advance the adoption of Linux. And to be honest, that's about as much as I'm going to read now, apart from the last line I'll read in a moment. And I think that really is Microsoft's policy on... You've got on piracy, they've got to look like they're doing something about it and at least make a reasonable stab at it, but they can't do too much about it, and they know that.
Yeah.
Because their market goes out the fucking window.
You see, I'm not 100% sure I agree with you. I mean, yes, I completely agree. If they just went... if they just said, we're going to turn on Windows Genuine Advantage for everything and every copy of Windows has to be licensed, then you'd immediately get loads of people moved to Linux because their Windows would just stop working. But they do still want to make the Chinese pay for Windows, being one of Bill Gates' mantras. So they're looking at things like, you know, trustworthy computing in order to make that kind of thing happen.
And continue.
Oh, yeah. So moving on. I thought that was a reasonable point and one I believe in myself. Yeah, regards, Jim, Calgary, Alberta. That's not his name, by the way. That's where he was from. Apart from the Jim bit. P.S. Could you modify the finger of God to zap Jono every time he says community? I'm really fucking sick of it.
He's not the only one.
Yeah, you're not alone in that.
Fuck off, storage boy.
Mr. Shaver. Alex Lowe writes in saying, dear stupid git.
Clearly,
Clearly you're working hard for the good reception here, I've got to tell you. Clearly you either didn't put much time into actually trying KDE 4, or you couldn't really find much wrong with it, since you went on for almost 20 minutes complaining about the theme. I'd love to see you review 4.1 or 4.2. Love the rest of the show, but you really missed some of it.
I'd love to see these people stop fucking whinging. We had some whinges on the forums, a couple of whinges. The thing I didn't get on the forum post, right, and I admit, I may have been a little bootworthy with one of the guys on there, but a couple of people said, don't lay into KDE, because Linus uses it. Like, that fucking matters. I mean, the guy writes a kernel. Why should I expect desktop advice from him, you know?
I think that actually makes him a bad person to take desktop advice from.
Yeah. I mean, it's nuts, but...
I mean, the thing is, everyone's going crazy. I actually think there's some really good discussion on the forum threads about KDE 4
at
the moment. And to me, I think we're all going crazy over nothing, really, because you've got to wait a year.
Yeah.
4.1 is when the time to start actually screaming and shouting about it.
I thought our review was reasonably fair as well, and the fact that we made quite clear we weren't focusing on bugs. We made the point that, you know, that some problems may be in Kubuntu, and, you know, we said, you know, it's a good effort, but it's not quite there yet, which seems to be the general perception of the KDE 4 Elite.
I don't think we really on the theme, either.
I
don't remember talking about the theme.
To me, everyone's forgetting that the functionality isn't complete. It's the APIs and the technologies underneath. That, the fact that you've got a visible desktop in the first place isn't the point of it.
Mm.
Except because it's the first release of the KDE 4.
There's much to be said.
I'm going to stop.
You do get the feeling that anybody who says anything less than KDE 4.0 is a genuine revolution in desktops, which will lead the world forward for the next 10 years. Anyone who says anything less than that is going to get a kicking from a small vocal section of the community.
Yeah, exactly. And they need to fucking get a life.
Jono, community manager.
Good that people are passionate about it.
Clearly not managing the Kubuntu community here, I think.
I think it's, you know, the community's got to take some responsibility in when people have a disagreement or a difference in opinion, to not get all whingy and school childish, you know, about it. And some people, very small minority of people, have been whingy and school childish about it. And most people have said, you know, we disagree with you, but the review was fair or whatever, you know. But anyway, moving on. Have you got one?
No, it's me now.
I've got one more, and then we'll talk about Look Radio Live in the US. Vendor Lock-in from John Locke. It's ironic. Hi, I listened with great interest to your argument about Vendor Lock-in, probably because it's his last name, and I think you're all missing quite a large point and using the wrong term, to boot. And you call yourselves a Linux show. Vendor lock-in, not all open source business, is the antithesis of vendor lock-in. Vendor lock-in is when a vendor uses some sneaky, underhanded, unadvertised method to make it impossible to recover any of your original investment if you ever decide to go with a different system. Vendor lock-in is accomplished by using all of the dirty tricks the proprietary software world has used for ages. Closed systems that lock away your data, hidden undocumented features, patents, and sneaky licenses. What you described on the show was not vendor lock-in. It's called healthy competition, and it's how open source software innovates. He goes on and on. I can't read it all out.
I think there's a big difference between healthy competition and vendor lock-in, and I think you can have vendor lock-in on open source stuff if you tried hard enough.
I think
it is quite possible.
I think you can do anything if you try hard enough.
This is slightly old news now. But Mandriva, Microsoft, Nigeria, busted.
It's the Adam Sweet Mandriva fan show.
Let's face it, I owe Adam Williamson a fucking lot now, don't I? I'm going to have to creep every time.
Adam Sweet's way of apologising to Adam Williamson is to ask him for a load of USB key rings. Speaking of which,
Lug Radio
live in the US.
In the US, which is on April 12th and 13th in the Metreon in San Francisco. For those of you who didn't know, go to lugradio.org/live.
We've been working hard on this, and we've got some speakers.
When Jono says we, he means me and him.
Yeah, it just certainly doesn't mean me.
Unlike the other two lazy arseholes.
But yes, people you will hear, the thing we've been concentrating on initially is speakers.
Yes, indeed.
And the speakers we have confirmed so far are...
Miguel de Caza
in... go on.
I was going to say Miguel... Well, one sentence for each of them. Miguel de Caza, prominent in the Mono and GNOME communities, co-founder of the GNOME project and working at Novell.
That was all one sentence, was it? Ian Murdoch, who founded Debian, and he's now chief OS strategist at Sun Microsystems.
Jeremy Allison, he is the lead developer of Samba and a noted supporter of software freedom. Very nice chap to boot.
Robert Love, the magnificent Robert Love, who invented Project Utopia and now works at Google on Project Android, the phones thing.
In fact, if you go back to season one, you'll hear us ripping the piss out of ACK for his unnecessary love of Robert Love.
But he was brilliant!
And your unnecessarily unkindness about Robert Love, because his talk was on at the same time as yours.
Well, yeah, exactly. Also, Robert Love's a really nice guy, because I've met him and drank beer with him.
He is a very nice guy, and I've also met and drank beer with him. And, you know, you done
sounded,
the talk.
You sounded like the mayor out of The Simpsons, then.
What, Mayor Quimby? Denise Cooper. She's worked in open source for a number of years. She used to work at Sun. I think she's now at Intel. Very prominent in the open source
the OSI.
She's going to be so proud to hear that, isn't she?
Ben Collins. He's the leader of the Canonical Kernel team.
And an absolute dude.
I really didn't think he looked like that, you know?
He's cut his hair now. He looks less of a redneck. He is a redneck, though. Val Henson. Val works at Intel, I believe, and she works on...
No, she's independent.
Right, yeah, she left.
She struck out on her own as a file systems consultant or something.
So Val, she works in the kernel and file systems, and she's very prominent in promoting women in open source as well. Speaking of women in open source...
Alison Randall, who... She's co-chair of OSCON, and she does a load of parrot hacking for Perl 6.
She was co-chair of OSCON.
Oh.
And then she thought, fuck that noise, I'm going to go to Lug Radio Live and talk there.
Wisdom. She sees the wisdom. Also, we're taller than Tim O'Reilly.
Which is important, you know. John Buckman is the CEO of Magnitune. We all love Magnitune. And he's going to be there to talk about Magnitune and Creative Commons and free music and all that kind of stuff.
Yep. Asa Raskin, who has the best hat in open source, despite not doing much open source stuff. Sorry, that's not fair, Asa. Runs Humanized, the usability consultancy, and he's now head of user experience at Mozilla Labs.
And, of course, the son of Jeff Raskin.
Yep.
Usability legend. Ian McKellar, not to be confused with Ian McKellen. Ian works at Songbird over in San Francisco,
and stars in the Harry Potter films.
Very cool guy. He was at Guardic
as Gandalf or whatever his name is. Dan Cagle, who
Cagle Rice and Pea.
That's not his name. Dan Cagle's leading light in the wine project.
Yes, indeed. We've also got the Bock man, Aaron Bockover, who is
Aaron Bockovich.
He's the lead author of the Banshee music player, which is currently being rewritten. So I think he's going to be there to show off some of the exciting crack that's going on there.
Yep, and we must all remember to salute him for explicitly blocking Jono's World of Metal by name.
It's been removed now, thank God. The World of Metal is available to you all.
And Eddie Mugliano, who we mentioned earlier, who sent us an email, he's looking at packaging across distros.
We have half of our speakers on the bill ready.
Yes.
But there's still another 15 slots available, or so.
Or so. Yeah. So we've got a hand wave about the number of speakers a bit.
Get your papers in to show at lugradio.org. Go to lugradio.org/live, click on the American flag, and click on the call for papers link, and send us your call for papers. We're not just after rock stars, we're after people who are just talk about interesting shit that they've been working on or that they're interested in.
And people who want to do buffs and all that kind of stuff as well.
Absolutely. Fucking lootly. And also, do a search on YouTube. Right, what's the URL for the video?
lugradio.org/live/USA2008/video.
It's Tony Whitmore, rather. did a trailer.
It's for... a promotional video for Lug Radio Live in the US.
Fucking
fantastic.
It's just absolutely excellent. We're really
impressed with what Tony Whitmore's done.
Not only is it really good on YouTube, I downloaded the video clip that Tony sent us originally, and I played it full screen on my enormous laptop earlier, and it looks brilliant in large.
Yeah.
It sounded really stupid then, didn't it?
We might have another bit before the music.
lugradio.org/live/USA2008/video.
Tony has done an excellent job with that, and Tony took care of a lot of the videoing Lug Radio Live 2007, obviously in the UK, and he's going to be in charge of all that kind of stuff at Lug Radio Live in the UK as well.
One thing we're going to start doing, and you can help us with that, is put that video different places, post it on your weblog, encourage people to go to Lug Radio Live by showing the video and then linking to it.
So there are instructions on that page about how to link that video from your weblog or your website or wherever. So go there and do that.
And the final thing in terms of Lugger Radio Live USA 2008 is on the website, there is a blog in which each of us, when we write about stuff on our blogs, and a few of the community people write about stuff on their blogs about Lugger Radio Live, it gets added to this blog like a planet, and you can subscribe to it. So if you want to keep up to date with either of the Lugger Radio Lives this year, you can subscribe to that blog and find out the latest information of what's going on. So, I think we're done.
We are done, I think.
Usual show at luggerradio.org for your emails, forums.luggerradio.org for...
Forums for your
KDE hate.
luggerradio.org/contact for the...
Voicemail.
Phone number thing.
For the voicemail number, yep.
Voicemail.
Basically, just go to lugradio.org and read the fucking website.
There's a lot of stuff there. Go look at the pictures and accuse us of boy bandery.
Yes.
And come and shoot us all on clan.lugradio.org in our non-free game of joy.
You look exceptionally camp right now.
I know, yeah. I'm actually not very warm, so I'm all hunched up and cross-legged and cross-armed and so on. So now
camper than a row of tents. Right. We'll see you in the next show.
Thank you very much for that.
See you in the next show.
Bye.